Hello there. Today is Wednesday, August 19th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up on day two of the Democratic National Convention, a surprise Republican endorsement and the woman who knows Joe Biden better than anyone.
We heard from his wife, Jill Biden, who is able to speak to some of the more personal sides of his life. He's obviously somebody who's been through a lot of tragedy in his life.
A mutiny in Mali leads to the resignation of the president and his government.
Soldiers went on the rampage, got to the arsenals, got the guns, started shooting in the air.
Also ahead, the World Health Organization says younger people are not immune to COVID-19. It's all on today's International Edition. Another prominent Republican has gone to bat for Joe Biden. In a taped video during the second night of the virtual Democratic National Convention, Cindy McCain spoke of the close friendship between Biden and her late husband, Republican Senator John McCain. Here's a short clip.
It was a friendship that shouldn't have worked. John, a former Navy pilot just released from a North Vietnamese prison. Joe, a young senator from Delaware. But in the 1970s, Joe was assigned a military aide for a trip overseas.
I was the Navy Senate liaison and used to carry your bags on overseas trips.
The son of a gun never carried my bags. He was supposed to carry my bags, David, but he never carried my bags.
John and Joe traveled thousands of miles together. The families got to know each other, gathering for picnics in the Biden's backyard.
They would just sit and joke. It was like a comedy show sometimes to watch the two of them.
Other big speakers Tuesday night included former President Bill Clinton.
You know what Donald Trump will do with four more years? Blame, bully, and belittle. And you know what Joe Biden will do? Build back better. It's Trump's us versus them America against Joe Biden's America, where we all live and work together. It's a clear choice. The future of our country is riding on it.
And young progressive star, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the keynote address was delivered by Dr. Jill Biden, the person who knows Joe Biden the best. Joining us now for details on night two of the convention is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. So, Catherine, before we get to the highlights of day two, given how many conventions you've covered over the years as a reporter, what's your take on the first ever virtual national political convention so far?
So instead of these 20, 30-minute speeches, we're getting a much more compressed speech from each of the speakers. They're giving these five-minute chunks that really lend themselves really well to social media. I've been seeing these bites shared on Twitter, on Facebook, really fostering discussion in a way that I don't know is possible with the traditional conventional speeches. So that the parties are going to take a step back and the next election cycle say, you know, this is actually working really well in a social media age. This is something that actually works to our advantage.
What about the level of intimacy? Do you think it actually adds that in some way when the speakers are looking directly in the camera and the way they've presented themselves?
There's the speakers who are coming to us from different locations. We're getting to see people's kitchens. We're getting to see people's backdrops in each of their home states, which lends a little bit of a different authenticity to each discussion. They're also experimenting with different formats, like talking to voters in their own home. They're having panel discussions. That's an interesting development that obviously would not have been possible in a traditional convention. So I think it's an adaptation that might actually be working in their favor again.
The first night, Monday, was all about unity. We saw that on full display with a number of Republicans, Democrats. They really tried to show the party's diversity and inclusiveness, and that clearly they were all calls on one team, no infighting, as reported back in 2016 when Hillary Clinton was a nominee. Now that we've gone through the second night, what was the message? What did you take away from it?
Well, certainly after coming off of the first night, which really did highlight that party diversity, and more importantly, highlighted their unity, which you talk to a lot of Democrats, they will make the joke that Democrats are a very diverse, rambunctious party who are not always in agreement with each other. And that interplay of ideas is something that gives them strength. But really what their strength on Monday night seemed to be was that they were all on one page. They were saying, if we want to beat Donald Trump in November, we all have to be behind Joe Biden. And that message really came through loud and clear. Tuesday night, they played off of that, and we really got to know Joe Biden as a person, because, of course, we heard from his wife, Jill Biden, who was able to speak to some of the more personal sides of his life. He's obviously somebody who has been through a lot of tragedy in his life, has lost family members, and really gives that sense of empathy when he's speaking to voters, that he's familiar with their struggles in a way because of what he's been through. His wife, Jill Biden, was really able to speak to that element of his personality.
And also notable, I think, Tuesday night, you could see that they were really trying to bridge the divide of the generations by the people that they had speaking.
Right. You know, conventions, regardless of their format, are always a way to look to the past of the party and then look ahead to its future. Remember that Barack Obama had his first big moment on the national stage at a Democratic National Convention in 2004. And of course, we're seeing some of the rising stars of the party get their own moment in the spotlight. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the freshman member of Congress, who, of course, has a huge social media following, has gotten a lot of attention in the past year or so, got her moment on the convention stage. That's something that she'll be able to look back on and say, that was kind of my national moment in the spotlight. That's the kind of thing that the conventions, not even just giving a presidential nominee their moment, but future presidential nominees and future party leadership their moment. That's what the convention is meant to do. And of course, when we hear from younger people in the party who want to assume that leadership post, the important part is that they get handed the torch from the old guard of the party, people like former President Bill Clinton, who spoke Tuesday night.
VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. The convention comes during a historic week in America. 100 years ago in August, U.S. women were granted the right to vote through the 19th Amendment to the Constitution. The amendment was introduced to Congress in 1878 and took more than 40 years to be passed and ratified by three-quarters of the states. VOA's Deborah Block looks at the history of the women's suffrage movement and women's equality today.
Feminists in the late 19th and early 20th centuries championed women's suffrage in the United States during a long and difficult struggle.
There's a lot of ridicule and scorn that's leveled at these women.
The fight for suffrage began in 1848 at the first Women's Rights Convention held in a church in Seneca Falls, New York. Delegates at the convention crafted a document that called for equality with men, including the right to vote.
They said all men and women are created equal. They borrowed from the Declaration of Independence, but they made that very significant change, adding, and women.
As women fought for suffrage for more than 70 years, Black women were not welcomed into the movement by whites.
But in their own organizations, anti-slavery societies, church conferences, civil rights organizations, and more, African-American women over the course of two centuries develop their own women's movement.
As the roles of women were changing in the early 20th century, a new generation of women continued the struggle. They stepped up their protests, organizing parades, silent vigils, and hunger strikes.
They go out into crowds of men at factory gates at lunchtime and stand on little stools. And they give what are called stump speeches. They give speeches for women's suffrage in public to rowdy male audiences.
After President Woodrow Wilson changed his stance to support the amendment in 1918, it was ratified 2 years later. A century later, however, many women face voter suppression, especially those who are Black.
Disproportionately face voter ID requirements. They face polling places that are shuttered. They are purged disproportionately from the rolls.
Inequalities like these may be resolved through the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment, proponents say, which was first introduced by suffragists in 1923.
You cannot discriminate on the basis of sex, and this would apply to the federal government and all of its policies and to the 50 states.
The future of the ERA is uncertain, but like the women who fought to vote, advocates say they will keep fighting for it. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
President Trump, meanwhile, Tuesday marked the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment by pardoning a women's leader who was convicted for voting in the 1872 election.
I will be signing a full and complete pardon for Susan B. Anthony. She was never pardoned. Did you know that? She was never pardoned. What took so long?
Also Tuesday, during a trip to the battleground state of Arizona, President Trump went on the attack against his Democratic rival, implying that if elected, President Joe Biden would open the floodgates to illegal immigration.
The Biden plan would unleash a flood of illegal immigration like the world has never seen. It's crazy. Biden's plan is the most radical, extreme, reckless, dangerous, and deadly immigration plan ever put forward by a major party candidate. It must be defeated, and it will be defeated on November 3rd.
Trump also repeated a key campaign promise from 4 years ago that Mexico would ultimately pay for border wall construction. The U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee Tuesday issued a stinging report as it wraps up a three-year bipartisan investigation of ties between the 2016 Trump campaign and Russian intelligence services, AP correspondent Tim McGuire reports.
The Senate Intelligence Committee concludes that a number of people with the 2016 Trump campaign had regular contact with Russian intelligence services and expected to benefit from those contacts. Virginia Senator Mark Warner, ranking Democrat on the committee, says the Russians had
unprecedented amount of Russian intervention and a myriad of contacts with individuals affiliated and associated with the Trump campaign.
The committee labels those interactions a grave counterintelligence threat. The findings echo, to a large degree, Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation. The investigation also dismisses President Trump's claims that the FBI had no basis to investigate. Trump has repeatedly called the investigations a hoax. Tim McGuire, Washington.
Hours after mutinous soldiers detained him and top officials and his government, Mali's president, Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, said Tuesday he was resigning and dissolving parliament. In a brief address broadcast on state television, Keita said, quote, "I want no blood to be spilled to keep me in power." The dramatic development comes after several months of demonstrations calling for him to resign. Earlier in the day, prior to word of the president's resignation, reporter Bram Posthumus in Mali provided International Edition Steve Miller with a picture of what was happening.
A mutiny broke out at a main military camp in Kati, which is 10 miles outside to the north of Bamako and basically Mali's main garrison town. So soldiers went on the rampage, got to the arsenals, got the guns, started shooting in the air, went out and cut off access to the camp to anyone happening to be in the vicinity of that place. And apparently they have now cut off the road between Kati and Bamako, which is downhill. And actually that road from that main military camp in Kati into Bamako goes right past the presidential palace. So it is a sensitive area. That's what we know so far.
Has the fighting been limited to this garrison, or has it spilled out into the surrounding area?
No, it looks like the fighting has been contained and has been limited to the sprawling military camp. It's a big place. Kati is essentially a military town, but it hasn't spread beyond the perimeters of either the camp, and from what I know, it hasn't even spread into the town of Kati, let alone into Bamako.
We know there's gunfire, but have there been any confirmed reports of casualties?
No, none whatsoever. This seems to have not led to any human casualties so far.
there were some reports of abductions having taken place. Have those claims been substantiated?
No, there's conflicting information about that as well. There were rumors spread on Twitter especially that said that the Minister of Finance had been abducted, which was then countered by others on the same social media saying, no, he's under protection of at least the part of the army that's which is majority still loyal to the government in place of President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita. So, again, conflicting evidence, lots of speculations. I think what we should retain so far is that whatever action is actually going on right now has been limited to the town of Kati, whereas obviously in Bamako there is tension. The reaction is that people tend to stay at home, they don't go out. There have been rumors also spread to the effect that people have been told not to come back to work after lunch. But these are all still in the realm of speculation. There is no hard and fast confirmation of any of this.
This is coming after months of protests against the president, asking for him to step down.
There is another message in French, an anonymous male voice circulating that claims that by 2 p.m. local time in Bamako, the president should have resigned, or else we're going to get you. It is absolutely not clear who that voice belongs to. It has been spread through, mainly through WhatsApp and through one or two social media. So again, this is something that seems to be designed to heighten tensions rather than to come to any solution. And the very latest is that youths have been reported together at the Independence Square where the demonstration have happened over the past months in support of the military. But how many there are, they seem to number in the hundreds rather than the much larger demonstrations that were organized by Imam Mahmoud Diko previously.
Reporter Bram Pastamus in Mali speaking early Tuesday with International Edition's Steve Miller prior to what is now confirmed that Mali's president has resigned. The UN Security Council says it does plan to hold a closed-door meeting on the situation. The World Health Organization said Tuesday it's concerned that the novel coronavirus spread is being driven by people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, many of whom were unaware they were even infected and posing a danger to vulnerable groups. WHO officials said this month the proportion of younger people among those infected had risen globally, putting at risk vulnerable sectors of the population worldwide, including the elderly and sick people in densely populated areas with weak health services. Judges in The Hague found guilty the lead defendant and acquitted three others in the 2005 car bomb assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. They also found no evidence of either Syria or Hezbollah participation. Lisa Bryant has more for VOA from Paris.
The 2,641-page, hours-long judgment wraps up a six-year trial by the Special Tribunal for Lebanon involving nearly 300 witnesses and tangled circumstantial evidence involving cell phone use.
The trial chamber, therefore, finds Salim Jamil Ayash guilty as a co-perpetrator of count one, conspiracy aimed at committing a
reading the unanimous act. Verdict, lead judge David Ray found the top defendant, Salim Jamil Ayash, guilty of homicide and of committing a terrorist act in the killing of ex-Prime Minister Hariri and 21 others. The three judges cited evidence showing Ayash had one of six mobiles used by the Hariri assassination teams.
The trial chamber finds Hassan Habib Merhai, Hussein Hassan Onesi.
But three other defendants, Hassan Habib Mehri, Hussein Onesi, and Asad Sabra, were acquitted for lack of enough evidence tying them to the blast, which injured more than 200 people. All four were tried in absentia. The court has now annulled the arrest warrants against those acquitted. The judges detailed Hariri's efforts to move his country away from Syria's political dominance at the time. They also established connections between the suspects and Hezbollah, but stopped at that.
The trial chamber is of the view that Syria and Hezbollah may have had motives to eliminate Mr. Hariri and some of his political allies. However, there was no evidence that the Hezbollah leadership had any involvement in Mr. Hariri's murder, and there is no direct evidence of Syrian involvement in it.
Judge Ray also noted evidence that Hariri had good relations with Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah in the months before the attack, and that he supported disarming Hezbollah only after achieving peace with Israel. Hezbollah has denied involvement in Hariri's death. Hariri was one of Lebanon's most prominent Sunni Muslim figures. His death helped to reshape the country's fractured politics. Tuesday's verdict was originally due earlier this month, but postponed after the August 4th Beirut port explosion. As with Hariri's killing, this latest blast has also triggered massive protests, this time against Lebanon's current political leadership, especially Hezbollah. Some have criticized the Hague trial for its expense and for concentrating on lower-end suspects rather than the leaders behind Hariri's killing. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. Travelers returning to Italy from Greece, Spain, Malta, and Croatia lined up on Tuesday at centers across Rome to be tested for coronavirus after the health ministry imposed mandatory screening on visitors to the four countries. Australia's prime minister said Tuesday that the country has signed a deal with drug maker AstraZeneca to secure a potential COVID-19 vaccine, joining a growing list of countries lining up supplies of the drug. AstraZeneca's candidate is seen as a frontrunner in the global race to deliver an effective vaccine against the coronavirus that has killed more than 770,000 people worldwide and infected nearly 22 million. And in Belarus Tuesday, President Alexander Lukashenko awarded medals for, quote, impeccable service to law enforcement officials who have helped him crack down on protesters who have been, for the past 10 days, demanding he step down. The United States and Poland have signed a deal to boost U.S. troop numbers in the country and to create a permanent U.S. base there. It follows an earlier U.S. decision to withdraw some troops from Germany. As Henry Ridgewell reports, many European allies see it as a political move following disputes over defense spending among NATO allies. But others argue the redeployment is essential to meet threats from Russia.
There are already around 4,500 U.S. troops in Poland, part of a rotating deployment in Eastern Europe. The new agreement between Warsaw and Washington will make that deployment permanent, with an additional 1,000 American troops on the ground. The headquarters of the U.S. Army 5th Corps will also be relocated to Poland from Germany. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo signed the deal Saturday during a visit to Poland.
Troop levels matter. The number of soldiers someone has someplace. As a former tank officer, I know that.
The deployment is strategically significant, says analyst Jonathan Isle.
This is about a deterrence to Russia and a reminder to all Europeans that all member states of NATO are entitled to the same security guarantee.
Poland says the deal will help defend against threats from Russia.
It is important to our security, and it is important that they should be deployed in Poland and not in Germany.
President Donald Trump announced plans last month to move 12,000 U.S. troops out of Germany, accusing Berlin of failing to meet NATO defense spending targets. He said around half would be sent home, with the rest deployed to other NATO allies.
We're protecting Germany, so we're reducing the force because they're not paying their bills. It's very simple.
U.S. officials say the partial withdrawal of troops from Germany and the deployment in Poland are not linked. Berlin has warned the moves could weaken the NATO alliance. Analyst Jonathan Isle says changes are long overdue.
But in reality, what it is a proper recalibration of the alliance more than 30 years after the end of the Cold War. What is the point of having many troops massed in Germany for purely historic reasons, but having no troops in the countries that feel most vulnerable and are indeed most threatened by threatening noises from Russia?
NATO allies deployed several thousand troops in Eastern Europe following Russia's forceful annexation of Crimea and invasion of Eastern Ukraine in 2014. Moscow has described the presence of U.S. troops in Poland as a threat to its security. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute. VOA's International Edition continues. The World Meteorological Organization says temperatures of 54.4 degrees Celsius reported Sunday at Furnace Creek, Death Valley, in the U.S. state of California, may be the third hottest on Earth. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN Weather Agency is assembling an international team of atmospheric scientists to verify the temperatures reported in Death Valley are legitimate. The WMO says that is a very complicated procedure and is likely to take several months to complete. If validated, however, world meteorological scientists say it would qualify as the third highest temperature ever recorded on the planet. The hottest temperature ever recorded was 56.7 degrees in Death Valley on July 10, 1913. The second hottest was set in July 1931 in Kabylie, Tunisia, at 55 degrees. The scorching conditions came as sweltering heat grips the west coast of the United States, with temperatures reaching the high 30s and 40s. WMO spokeswoman Claire Nullis says the U.S. National Weather Service expects the intense heat to continue for a while.
The National Weather Service in Las Vegas, which covers the Death Valley area, tweeted overnight, "We are in the midst of a long-duration extreme heat event. Another run at 130 degree Fahrenheit plus temperatures in Death Valley remains possible."
The WMO says extreme high temperatures are part of a global trend. It says July was the hottest July on record for the Northern Hemisphere, and Arctic sea ice was the lowest on record for the month. It says Western and Central Europe experienced another heat wave last week. Japan recorded temperatures of more than 40 degrees Monday at Hamamatsu, and Siberia has experienced a prolonged heat wave. The WMO currently is in the process of verifying the record high temperature of 38 degrees reported June 20th in Siberia. If proven, that would be the highest temperature ever recorded in the Arctic Circle. Nullis tells VOA the relationship between climate change and the extreme weather events is inescapable.
We are seeing more intense, extreme heat waves, more frequent. They're starting earlier, they're finishing later than in the past. This is consistent with everything that we expect from climate change. So of all the extreme weather events that we see, the relationship between heat and climate change is the one which is the clearest.
Man-made climate change is caused by the emission of greenhouse gases, including carbon dioxide, nitrous oxide, and methane into the atmosphere. Scientists agree that drastically cutting greenhouse gas emissions is the key to tackling global warming. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
An actress, Reese Witherspoon, wants to help find a country music star. The Oscar winner will executive produce a series for Apple Plus called My Kind of Country. It's described as a hybrid series with a music competition, but will also have a documentary element as well. This will be the first competition series to air on Apple Plus. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Bunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening.
Dreams were lightning, thunder were desire. This old house would have burned down a long time ago. Made me
Crossings. Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Ah. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.